Let me just take up two matters from the last speaker. First, there is a fifth regional centre that is starting this month, namely Bristol. So the South West is now to be covered. Secondly, it is not, I'm afraid, altogether surprising that there's been an increase in litigants in person. This is a result of the cuts to legal aid and the difficulties of finding representation. It's a little short-sighted because cases involving litigants in person can take up much more court time because the judge then feels an obligation to see whether there actually may be some good point lurking in the verbiage or the bad points that often are raised. So it is an unfortunate position, and I'm afraid it's not going to get any better. Mike Fordham has referred to a number of issues of importance, which may, one hopes, be developed in the future. I don't obviously want to cover the same ground as he has. And I suppose, as he said, I'm looking backwards and he is looking forwards. Although the backward look will throw up, I think, some matters which we can take for the future. I can take him up, for example, on onus to some extent. As you may know, the courts have decided, I forget the name of the case, it was Lord Justice Simon Brown, I think, that for habeas corpus, or where there was an alternative, habeas corpus or judicial review tended to be more desirable because it meant that one could go into the matter in greater detail. Habeas corpus requires a defendant to show that the incarceration, the detention, is lawful. Is there any difference in the approach in judicial review? The answer, I think, is and should be no. Is that perhaps a possible starting point for an argument based upon onus in all cases? The sixth edition of De Smith, October 2007, noted that previous editions had been entitled Judicial Review of Administrative Action. The words of administrative action were omitted, a change made, in fact, in 1999 in the updated paperback edition of the 1995 fifth edition. The reason behind that change was the recognition of the mounting importance of review of high-level policy decisions and of legislation. Of course, secondary legislation has always been subject to judicial review. But the advent of the Human Rights Act and the application of what I will call loosely Euro law has meant that the lawfulness of primary legislation can be subjected to judicial review. One effect is perhaps to tend to blur or even perhaps to eliminate the distinction between constitutional and administrative law. Certainly when I was at university, the two were regarded as distinct subjects, although I think my tutor dealt with both. Nevertheless, there was a real distinction between the two. I don't want to get into the academic arguments whether the ultra vires principle is the correct way to look at the basis for the court's approach to judicial review. The CCSU case in 1985, just outside the 25 years that I'm supposed to be limited to, sets out the grounds, namely procedural propriety, rationality, and legality. The first can be said to be based on fairness. The second, I have always thought slightly misleading, because apart from Wensbury unreasonableness, it includes a failure to have regard to a material or having regard to an immaterial consideration. The third, I think, speaks for itself. An important decision as a starting point, in particular in an age of continuing privatisation, I hate the word, is DataFin in 1987. It is possible for private bodies not now to say that they are not amenable to judicial review if they are taking over a function that used to be dealt with by a government or a quango or, I suppose, any other public body. I have mentioned the possibility of challenging primary legislation. In the Euro context, the decision of the House of Lords in the Queen against the Secretary of State for Employment, ex parte the Equal Opportunities Commission in 1995, confirmed the power of the court to declare that primary legislation was incompatible with community law. And of course, community law prevails. The decision in Three Rivers, 2003, made clear that there was a right of compensation against the state for a failure to comply with Euro law. So at least we have a chink that compensation can be provided, and the Frankovic litigation produced the same effect. There is the Human Rights Act power to declare a provision of primary legislation to be incompatible, but of course that does not require Parliament to change the law. However, there is a right of action for damages for breach of human rights, provided the individual concerned can show that he is a victim of the breach, and that usually is not difficult. So again, there is a chink in the failure to provide for a right of compensation. As Mike indicated, the courts over the years have indicated that there ought to be such a right. I suppose the only equivalent or the only possible route to some form of compensation is via the Ombudsman. If maladministration can be shown, then the Ombudsman does have power to award compensation. But that is not necessarily appropriate or able to cover all cases. Whether that will happen, whether we will develop that way, I do not know. Again, Mr. Fordham referred to the more fundamental suggestion that parliamentary sovereignty is subservient to the rule of law. In Jackson and the Attorney General, the Hunting Act case, in 2006 appeal cases, in which the claimant sought a declaration that the Hunting Act was not an act of Parliament, because having regard to the Parliament Act of 1911, it should be treated as secondary legislation. But Lord Steyne said that the supremacy of Parliament was a general principle, but the judges, and this is the quotation, the judges created the principle. If that is so, it is not unthinkable that circumstances could arise where the courts may have to qualify a principle established on a different hypothesis of constitutionalism. In exceptional circumstances involving an attempt to abolish judicial review or the ordinary role of the court may have to consider whether this is constitutional, fundamental, which even a sovereign parliament acting at the behest of a complacent House of Commons cannot abolish. Strong stuff. Lord Hope, too, made the point that parliamentary sovereignty was no longer, if it ever was, absolute. I think the Scots have been rather more in advance of us in their approach to parliamentary legislation. While affirming that Parliament could do what it liked, Lady Hale was prepared to say that the court might even reject an attempt to remove governmental action affecting an individual's rights from judicial review. An attempt to insulate tribunals from judicial review by calling them supreme courts of record, of course, failed in Cart. And I would draw your attention to the masterly historical analysis in the Divisional Court by Lord Justice Laws. They, in Cart, have adopted a second appeal test. And I imagine that that test should now apply in the county courts as well, because the case of Siva Subramaniam which went rather further against that, was disapproved. And of course, you have the Queen against the Lord Chancellor, ex-party Whittam, in 1998, which struck down a regulation abolishing the power to remit fees, because it effectively prevented access to the court by an impoverished individual, and such access was a constitutional right. Maybe removal of legal aid could be attacked on the same sort of basis. The policy now can be reviewed is clear. In Lumber, an enormously long and in part somewhat incomprehensible decision of the Supreme Court, it decided at least, and I think this is clear, that there was a duty to publish policy and to follow it. And it was not good enough to apply a secret policy which was not in accordance with what had been published. And the necessity for publication is to enable a person affected to make meaningful submissions upon it before any decision adverse to him, or which might be adverse to him, was made. It would be unfair, or perhaps a breach of legitimate expectation, not to follow it. And indeed, in that particular case, the unpublished policy which was relied on was regarded as unlawful. Legitimate expectation. Of course, the very important decision in respect of legitimate expectation was Coughlin in 2001. The test applicable is that a public body must be kept to a promise as to how it would behave in the future, which in because such a promise would induce a legitimate expectation of a benefit which was substantive, and to frustrate that expectation could be so unfair as to amount to an abuse of power. It is rooted in unfairness, but the promise must be clear, unambiguous, and devoid of any relevant qualification. The change in Coughlin was that before that it was thought that a legitimate expectation only went to procedural matters. Coughlin made it clear that it also went to substance. Mike has referred, and I gather others, to mistake of fact as a ground for challenge. Again, that I suppose can be said to be based on fairness, but the case of E against the Secretary of State for the Home Department in 2004 in the Court of Appeal made it clear that it is rather more general. Possibly one can put it in irrationality as a failure to have regard to a material consideration if there's an error of fact, but it is wider than that, as the court made clear. It has to be, of course, an error of fact which is established. When I was at the bar dealing with judicial review, the matter was always approached on the basis that if there were factual differences, the court had to accept the facts as put forward by the defendant body. That, I am glad to say, is no longer the case. Of course, there are situations where there is a need to decide an issue of fact following the approach of Khawaja. Remember, that was the case which dealt with whether there had been an entry by deception. And it was said, in order to establish, the court would have to be satisfied that there was indeed a deception. Recently, in A against Croydon, the Supreme Court has extended that to age assessment in relation to would-be asylum seekers. But it hasn't, I'm glad to say, gone a great deal further than that. A, I think, was a thoroughly bad decision, but that's by the way. It wasn't, in fact, an appeal from me, so I don't have any particular axe to grind in that respect. Sinaji, Queen against Sinaji, if I pronounce it correctly, in 2006 appeal cases, is an important decision relating to mandatory or discretionary requirements. It was a confiscation order case, and there was a requirement that, according to the statute, that no more than 6 months after the decision of the Crown Court, the conviction in the Crown Court, was to be allowed for confiscation proceedings, save in exceptional circumstances. But their lordships decided that one had to look at the policy behind the Act, which was to ensure that criminals did have the profits from their crime confiscated, and thus a failure to comply with the apparently mandatory time requirements didn't make the decision unlawful. One has always to look at what is the purpose of the Act in question. Even if a requirement appears to be mandatory, a requirement of time, for example, then that can be overturned if it is clear that the principle of the Act is such that it ought to be. I think a principle which has perhaps sometimes been overlooked is found, and I'm grateful to Dinah Rose for this one, in the Queen against the Chief Constable of North Wales, ex parte Thorpe, in 1999. That case, in fact, concerned disclosure of information damaging to an individual. He'd been, or she, I forget who it was, had been convicted, I think both, husband and wife, had been convicted of sex offences. The question was whether this should be disclosed to those who lived near where they were living. And for obvious reasons, if it was disclosed, they had to leave the area. The principle, though, is set out by Lord Bingham. And the principle that he set out was that there was a fundamental rule of good administration which the law recognised and would enforce. And that did not depend upon a breach of, for example, confidentiality or any other private law right. I'm not sure that that has really been pursued, that particular basis has been pursued very much since. It does, on the face of it, appear possibly to open the door to situations which have not been opened hitherto. Let me deal with one or two discrete matters. Reasons, again, I understand that's been gone into. Not yet a general duty. We haven't quite got there. We've been developing the requirement for reasons. I think perhaps the way to look at it is that even if there is no duty to give reasons, a failure to do so is at the peril of the body concerned, because the courts will be inclined to take the view that if you don't give reasons, it's because you haven't got any good reasons for the decision in question. Reasons do not have to be lengthy, they do not have to be elaborate. What they should do is to deal with the issues which clearly are important, because normally a decision will have been made where there have been perhaps indications from various sources that there are concerns about this, that, or the other. And it is the this, that, or the other that should be prima facie dealt with in the reasons. I hope the time will come when one can say that the courts have said you must give reasons unless there is a clear indication that they need not be given. And such a clear indication is needed. The protective costs orders, again, that's an important development. It does enable, in some cases, those who have a real interest in dealing with a particular decision to be able to litigate against it. It is particularly important in environmental cases. And indeed, it is, in my view, strongly arguable that a failure to ensure that an individual can take an environmental case against a public body, frequently planning, but not always, without undue expense, would be contrary to the European directive, which requires that an individual is able to take proceedings against such a decision. Delay, 3 months, or promptly. Bear in mind, perhaps, that in, again, Euro cases, where there is a directive or the court has to act, or the public body has to act in accordance, promptness is out. The European Court has, court at Luxembourg has said that that is not proper because it is not clear. And I think it probably did it because it didn't fully understand our system of promptness, although I think Lord Justice Schuman, was, I think, sitting, and it was a case against Ireland, and the Irish procedure is exactly the same as ours, promptly 3 months, promptly or in any event within 3 months. But otherwise, promptly is still needed. Immigration, of course, is a major problem for the court. We are swamped by immigration cases. And interestingly, although I think 4 or 5 years ago, I was given figures which showed that there was no real difference between the percentage of cases in which permission was granted, whether immigration or otherwise, that situation is no longer the case. In immigration cases, there is a much lower grant of permission than in other forms of civil judicial review. It may be that that is partly as a result of the increased use of Article 8 as a basis for saying you can't remove me because of the effect on my partner, the child or children that I have fathered in this country while I've been staying here unlawfully over the past 7 or 8 years, or whatever it may be. Of course, one major problem has been the failure of UKBA to act promptly and to deal with these cases in good time, building up. I think I saw somewhere that the backlog had reached 400,000 cases at one stage. And of course, the longer someone's here, the more they put down roots, the more difficult it is to contradict an Article 8 claim. And the worrying thing is that it is Article 8 claims that are leading, or so we read, this government to say, oh, well, we should pull out of the ECHR because we're being swamped with unwanted cases. I suppose they do appreciate that if they pull out of the ECHR, they've also got to pull out of the EU, because, of course, the EU directive is now in force in relation to humanitarian and asylum protection. But there it is. Perhaps that's a matter it's not for me to go into, but it is an interesting note. The other matter I can touch on is special advocates. Again, whether it is a good thing or a bad thing, it is not for me. However, in terrorist cases, there is no question but that there must be some sort of arrangement whereby the full evidence can be taken into account, because regrettably there are some very dangerous individuals around. I've dealt with enough terrorist cases myself to appreciate that. But of course, there's got to be fairness so far as one can achieve it. I personally take the view that, generally speaking, the special advocate procedure was satisfactory. I know that is not the view of others. We are landed, though, with the decision of the Supreme Court in El Roy, which, frankly, is a decision which I regard as thoroughly bad. but the trouble is, one is bound by it. And, although I'm not averse to failing to follow something which I don't think is necessarily binding, I would find it difficult to go against a decision of the Supreme Court. Thank you.